So, just in case any of you are wondering about your minds, we did have a visitor, but we still have a visitor. Made a couple of visits and hasn't completed the second. This visitor's a black cat. Now, I don't know if anyone's superstitious, but if you feel something like a creature nearby, you may be feeling something that is nearby. I think this particular creature's in there right now. But, spent a little bit of time walking around the room. Some of you would have been aware of that. Sorry, there was a cat, a black cat, in the room, and some of you would have been aware of that, and some of you might have felt or sensed something and wondered if there was something happening without knowing. But it wasn't anything other than a cat. And in a way, that's a useful link into what's perhaps useful to consider as we continue with this theme and the reflection and the contemplation of death, of mortality, where it takes us. When we open up to, when we allow ourselves to be touched by, and it's not an easy thing or always a welcome thing to engage in, to be touched by the potential for the feeling of loss, which maybe won't be our experience, because maybe it'll be that our death is quick and clean, and we don't have to miss anybody because we're not there anymore. And we didn't get to even realize we were about to miss them before it happened. That's occasionally what happens for somebody. It's probably not what happens for most. But we sense there's this loss or this grief or there's something about that territory that is connected. So that loss, or the contemplating death, or the engaging with the reality of death, invokes or brings us more into contact with grief and loss. And it can be the actual grief and loss we've experienced in our lives of loved ones, or of things, situations, circumstances that were really important to us that we lost. May have been our family or family members, may have been our countries or our land or some element of our inner life that we lost touch with somewhere in the journey of our lives. Probably all of us have some sense of what that might have been for ourselves, of what we have lost. They become significant elements of the stories we have that we carry with us. And we might equally have the sense of that anticipated loss, or that seeing the potential for future loss and the grief that will bring or may bring for us. And if we actually really let ourselves be touched, and it's important, and that's part of why it's in this territory, to let ourselves be touched by that grief, to not too quickly sort of explain it and, oh, it's not going to be that bad, or it'll be okay, I'll be all right. Yeah, you probably will be all right. But it's still not that it's going to be easy to be all right. They're not the same thing, always. But if we let ourselves actually be touched by it or make contact with it, what also starts to happen is we recognize something, or we can begin to recognize that there's something in the sense of grief and loss itself that speaks to us of a perhaps deeper, more primal or primary loss, which is also very much the territory and the interest of spiritual practice and of Buddha's teaching, to understand what we've lost contact with that we could call truth, that we could speak of in language that might sound religious, might refer to spirit, that which is sacred, that which is divine, as kind of language. For some of us, it's language that doesn't really work because it's been sadly so mistreated and misused by religions, all of them, at times, not always. And yet there's something that is at the core of what it means to be a human being that draws us to understand what it means to be alive and to discover what it is that lies at the heart of our existence. And so far as we're not in touch with that, so far as we find ourselves somehow distant from that, there's a painfulness, there's a grief, there's a sense of loss, of which all other losses are in a way simply expressions and reminders. And all other grief is simply, in a way, again, expressions and reminders of. I'm not in that saying that therefore the grief that we encounter and the losses we encounter are somehow less significant. I'm not saying that at all. But that they are not existing in isolation or apart from that deeper loss of contact with what we could call our truth or the truth of life. And so when we contemplate the territory and the topic of death, part of what we're doing is we're engaging with something which we can't really engage with, except by making up ideas. And some of what I've been offering are ideas, constructions, contemplations, born out of just thinking about or imagining, which is useful, it has its place. But in fact, as far as death is concerned, we do not know and cannot know what that is or will be. And so, when we fear death, we fear the thought of it, the thoughts we have about it, the ideas we have about it. When we don't fear death, it's that we don't fear the thoughts we have about it, the ideas we have about it, the beliefs we have about it. Because death is, in that sense, a concept for us, so far as we're relating to it from our ideas, our beliefs. Now, whether those ideas evoke a sense of comfortable retirement and a relatively, you know, well-appointed mansion, or whether they evoke sort of just a complete blanking of nothing thereafter, or something kind of unpleasant and difficult going down below, you know. Those kind of ideas are just ideas. And I'm not really myself that interested in the ideas we have. Not that they aren't interesting, but that for me they don't really contribute to what is transformative and liberating in this territory. And so what death represents for us, and this isn't so much an idea here, is more the experiential impact of turning towards it and turning towards the different layers and the ways, as we've been doing, that it affects us, our death, the death of others, the loss of contact with what we love. What we can perhaps start to notice about that is that we get quite, and some of you might have noticed, that it's sort of like the sense of me starts to get a bit sort of agitated by the process, and some of the anger and contraction that we might have noticed is also part of, one of the things that anger does, it gives me a very strong sense of me. I know, and I'm right, and they aren't, and it's like this. And there's a certain solidity at the centre of it. That's part of what's attractive. Even if it's painful or even if we know it's unskillful, part of what's attractive in that kind of reaction, and there's no judgment of it, it's just how it is that it gives us a solid sense of, I'm here, and don't mess with me. You know, that's part of what it's offering to us. And yet if we really contemplate the truth of what we actually know about death is, that the very sense of what we take ourselves to be can't be projected beyond it in any reliable way. What we take ourselves to be. We can't know the condition of me beyond that point.
We actually can't know it beyond the point we're in, to be honest, but we can kid ourselves that we do. It's a bit of a stretch to kid ourselves that we really know what condition me, I, this self will be in beyond that. So there's a way, of course, in which religions tend to present answers to reassure us, and the modern religion of Western culture, science, presents its own answer, and it is a religious thing. If you see the degree of emotional charge that gets associated with challenging accepted scientific positions, you realise it's not a rational event going on. Not to say there isn't rationality in wisdom and intelligence in science. It's not a bad thing in itself. But it has replaced, in much of Western culture, the primacy of telling us how things are that religion used to offer. And the science of the day says, well, after death, it's all over. Nothing happens after that. And as I was having a conversation with someone, it's maybe that it's true, but we don't know that any more than we know that there will be some further existence after death. And from where I'm sitting, both of those positions are a consolation. Both of them give us a sense of knowing what's going to come. Even if what's coming is it's just all over and nothing happens. And that takes us away from the direct and, I would say, more challenging confrontation with the unknownness of what will be. What will be? And that unknownness that's made evident in having no real ability to know. We can believe passionately, sure, about what will happen. But we can't know. Because know is based on experience. Maybe we've had the experience and we know about it. Then that's your situation. Certainly not mine. I have no experiential, conscious access to any knowledge of death beyond that it seems to be heading in this direction, which is just based on seeing what happens to everyone else. But even that you can't, in one sense, be sure of, just to contradict everything I've said so far. You know, we tend to operate on the basis that because every time I've dropped something, I let go of something, it falls, that every time I do let go of something, it will fall. And probably that will go on forever. But actually, what we need to do sometimes is check and see what happens. This could be a diversion. I'm just catching myself here. Knowledge is not as absolute as we tend to imagine. And not having a reference point for the sense of who I am. In a way, that's what death is. Death is the end of that. When we have that reference point, basically what happens is we operate within a bubble of sensing that, yeah, I'm this and I know how the world is and this is how things are. And essentially we go to sleep on ourselves, in ourselves. And that going to sleep is actually what these teachings and these particular contemplations are encouraging us to wake up from. The way we fall asleep in our ideas and our beliefs. So it's scary to not know. It's scary not to be able to predict and therefore prepare for or control what's going to happen. And all the preparing for and controlling and attempting to predict and get ready for the various events and experiences of our life, in the end, when it comes to death, they're not going to take us all the way. That'd be useful, but they won't take us all the way. And really the only death we can confront here and now is an entry into the unknown. To say, I don't know what's going to be. And something in us has to die to let that go, to let that end fully. Something in us has to die in the here and now to let in that we don't know coming, not just at the point of death, but at lunchtime. We don't actually know what it will be like to eat a bowl of soup at lunchtime, should we have one coming. And yet, we so strongly compelled to establish a sense of certainty around the things that make us feel unsettled. And in Dharma practice, we are invited and encouraged to establish ourselves in that uncertainty. To actually bring ourselves, in whatever way might work for us, to the place where we can say, actually, I don't know. I don't know what death is. In order to understand death, we need to understand life, to ask not just who dies, but what is it that lives? What is this that's happening that's going to stop? Obviously the fact that it's going to stop at some point is going to have an effect. But we sort of often are coming to that from a certain degree of assumptions and beliefs about what it is that's happening already. And so, in terms of the practice here, the practice is learning to let go. It's always the practice. It just gets reconfigured in different shapes. Learning to let go. Letting go initially of our resistance to being affected by the reality of death. Our wanting to keep it at a safe distance. The mortality, the separation, the loss. The unpleasant, difficult, and maybe painfulness of the process itself, let alone the eventual outcome. To let ourselves be impacted by that. By the, as I also said, the sort of the loss, the sense of what it will be to be without that which our heart relies on for joy. We tend to love those things that bring us joy, whether it be a clear day and sunlight flickering through the leaves or the skylights, or whether it be a beloved person or being in our life. Things that bring us joy. And yet these two, just as that sense of grief, these two are things that represent, that point for us, that show us something about, something more fundamental and deeper than just the experiences and the situations we encounter. That which touches us with grief and that which brings us the sweetness of joy. Expressions of life and of love and of connection and of separation and coming together and coming apart are inherent and intrinsic in the nature of life, and we see this again and again. We come together, we go apart, or sometimes we come apart. We get ourselves together and then we come apart. We feel like at the end of a day of practice we've got it together around loving kindness and compassion, and then we go home and realize it comes apart in a different situation. That getting it together and coming apart, coming together and going apart with others. This is the story, the subtext, the thread of our lives. A series of meetings of this breath that comes in. And it's keeping us alive right now. If it didn't come in right now, we'd be in distress very quickly. We'd be in terror not long after. And if it still didn't come in, then we'd be dead. But it comes in. And it goes out. And it's just that little meeting with this remarkable experience of life doing what it does to nourish itself for just this next little phase of in-breath and out-breath. And it's just this. It comes and it goes. It comes and it goes. And so what death tells us is that everything's going to be taken. Everything that we lean on, that we rest on, that we demand or require or expect to be there for us, at one point, at one day, in one way or another, will no longer be there. So we learn to let go. What letting go means is that we start to examine the way in which we define ourselves. We need to look at how it is we conceive ourselves. Because if we conceive ourselves as nothing other than this mind, heart, body experience, and actually we're not anything other than it, it would seem, then clearly the death of this, it's all over. And we wonder, why is life like this? This remarkable expression of whatever things we might see it as. And then it comes to nothing in the end. It comes to nothing in the end. And yet, maybe by really letting ourselves be open to and affected by this truth, by this experience, by not just death, but equally by birth, by the fact we see things coming into existence, and by the life that, as someone was speaking about earlier, we see animated within the forms, within what we call me or you or the cat, wherever it's gone. And something in that can perhaps just start to touch us in a different way. When we learn to let go of everything we're holding on to, and as we learn to let go more and more, because it's a process, it seems, for most of us, maybe for everyone, but I haven't talked to everyone, so I don't know. Am I getting too quiet again? Tell me if I am.
Okay.
A little. Yeah. Now I need to remember sometimes. So as that letting go happens, the effect of letting go is it starts to open up space. And initially space is something we're not always comfortable with. In a way, death represents for us a lot of space. Nothing to do, no to-do lists, no unwanted calls from, sort of providers of services. It's going to stop. It's like, at one level, we can relate to it like that. It's like there's a small death that happens and we just step half away from all of that by coming here on retreat. And just say to the world, actually, you can get by without me for Sunday. Sometimes we wonder if it'll manage. Will it really get by without me? All these people out there don't seem to think they will. They need me. They want me. They tell me they do. But the truth is, they can and they will get by without us for the Sunday. And one day, they'll have to get by without us, and this world will have to get by without us completely. And for good. And, it's like good to give some practice for the world to make sure it knows how to cope. Sometimes that's how I think of going on retreat. If the world gets some practice at coping, it'll be hard, I know, but coping without me to make sure it runs okay. Huh? So if we see that we are one of these things that comes and goes, because we are that, something that comes and goes, perhaps we start to become interested and the question of whether there may be or what might be that does not come and go. And this was the Buddha's question himself when he realized in the encounter with the
aged, the sick, and the dying and dead persons that he met before he set out on his quest. What came to me, he said, if this happens to everybody, and I'm paraphrasing it, why should I keep pursuing things and situations that are subject to birth and death? If I am subject to birth and death, would it not make sense to look for that which is not subject to birth and death? To seek for nibbana, he said, the freedom from suffering, from that which is subject to birth and death. And to the degree that we begin to let go of our hold on things and our identification and attachment with self as being defined by experiences or defined by the presence of this body, which is just here for a relatively short time in sort of cosmological history, it's just a blink or a flicker of existence that we have on this planet for all the fullness of our lives that can happen in that moment of cosmic sort of scale time. There's a sense sometimes that maybe comes, and we may start to feel in that openness that there isn't just this, and yet there's nothing else, and yet there isn't just this, but there's nothing else. Religions often come up with something else as an attempt to suggest that it's not just this. So, to speak a little more to that topic, I had an interesting and for me very powerful and touching experience when I was practicing in Asia. One occasion in a monastery where I'd been the previous year and really enjoyed to be practicing there. And one of the things I enjoyed was the animals. The monasteries in Asia tend to operate as something of a sanctuary for all beings. And so often, not just the animals, but also many of the people, lives are very hard, very difficult. But in the monasteries, they would at least be safe. And so you would find, dogs and cats and roosters and any number of random animals all over the place. And I was on this occasion doing walking meditation and just really enjoying the puppies that were running around on the grounds of the monastery. And the puppies, they're just so full of life, just this running about, having fun. They weren't, they weren't super skinny, but it's not like they were sort of like living off the fat of the land, so to speak. Yeah. But they seem to just have that joie de vivre, excuse my rubbish French pronunciation, but that sense of joy of life and just fullness and brightness. And they would, come running past when you were doing slow walking meditation, just bump into your foot to see if you were really on balance and present, or someone's come and just, help you eat your lunch, and obviously you couldn't quite manage it yourself. If you took your eye off your plate for more than a moment, that's what happens, And I used to just love seeing these little creatures. And having been there the year before, I'd had the same experience. And on this occasion, I suddenly realised, and it shocked me to the core, I realised that I thought these puppies were the same ones I'd been looking at last year. And I'd, for about a week or 10 days by then, been amongst them, loving them, thinking, it's so good to see you guys again. And I realised in that moment, of course, oh my gosh, there's no way those puppies from last year, they've grown up. Not all of them will have survived. They're going to be, relatively adult-sized dogs. These little creatures, they're new. And yet something in me had believed and been completely convinced they were the same creatures. And the sense that came to me very clearly in that was that, yes, puppies come and go, but puppy nature, it's the same. It doesn't change at all.
And so this practice asks us to open ourselves up to being touched by our life. And that includes opening ourselves up in the way that contemplating death touches us and encountering it affects us. So that in the practice we start to learn to not pick up our experiences to define ourselves by. To not say, I am this, or I am not that. I am like this, but I'm not like that. Because if we watch and if we see, what we find is that sometimes I'm like this, and sometimes I'm not. Sometimes this is possible for me, and sometimes it isn't. Whatever the this or that might be, it changes. It changes. And if we start to just allow ourselves to be touched by life, be open to it, it starts to speak to us differently. And what we start to see is if we're interested in being free from death, from the shadow that death seems to cast over our lives at times, we actually need to be free from birth equally. You know, the Buddha sometimes said, why do you grieve when someone dies? You could equally grieve when they're born rather than celebrating, because being born, they will die. But we somehow put these things apart. And of course, one could equally say, why not celebrate when someone dies for how wonderful it was that they were born and that we had the blessing of their life? And of course, both of those experiences would be appropriate or could be real for one, at the birth or the death, and in fact, at any interval in between. We could both commiserate and celebrate the reality of existence and the way it's showing up right now. But there's a way in which we identify with things that essentially in Dharma teachings means taking birth, believing ourselves to be this body, this mind, this that comes into form and shape, this experience, this pattern of habitual ways of relating. And there's a truth to all of that, but there's also something that blinds us. Because that's not the whole truth. It's not necessarily the most fundamental truth. And so, you know, as there was this, the way that Dharma teachings look at it, we're understanding what is it that leads us to take birth. Because having taken birth, there will be a dying. If we identify with something as being who I am or what I am or how I am, then at some time, at some point, through the process of change or the encounter with death, that basis for identifying, for defining, for solidifying, for making some certainty out of an idea of who I am will be taken away from us. And if we haven't really attended to this well, the loss of that will be challenging and difficult to navigate. The loss of the sense of who we are. That for many of us, we are holding at the very core of our existence as a fundamental prop, and which we avoid thinking too much about death, because the very nature of death challenges that ability to hold that kind of central prop of our existence. Yeah, Buddhist teacher Ajahn Amaro was at a conference in Asia some years ago, and he described a conversation he had with someone, because the topic came up about contraception, abortion and sterilization, and the whole, you know, in a way, ethical and moral ambiguities in that territory, which sometimes religions take very strong and not always helpful positions that are very absolute. And we may have our own feelings, I'm not meaning to make too much of that territory, but rather interestingly, when asked what his position or the sort of the teachings had to say about all this, Ajahn Amaro, he responded, he said, well, actually, as far as I can tell, the whole of the Buddhist teachings are concerned with avoiding rebirth. The rather a unexpected response, I imagine. But what that is, to see that that process of identifying with what it is we have allowed ourselves to believe or convinced ourselves we know is what we are. This is at the heart of the issue of life and of death. And so there's that certain unknownness that we confront, that certain unknowableness that death brings when we reflect on it, that we can't really get our head around it. We get our head around some ideas about it, but that's as far as we go. And the idea that death means sort of complete cessation of all experience, or just a quick shift into another form of something rather similar in a different shape. If we don't hold on to those ideas, if we actually practice the letting go that the Buddha invited us as a liberating practice, and that the contemplation of death is a support for letting go, for allowing ourselves to be fully, completely and unconditionally affected by what we are affected by, in both its at times tragedy and at times beauty, the loveliness, the painfulness, the confusion, all of it that comes, that we know so well, but allow ourselves to be open to it, to not take any of it as defining who we are. Then really we open ourselves to a potential for immense and liberating discovery, for understanding what it is that the Buddha's teachings point to, what it is that's at the heart of our life. That makes sense of birth and death and life itself without explaining it away. So there's a poem by a Native American elder called Red Hawk, entitled, "The Time Comes When It Is Easier to Die." It was given to me by a student in America many years ago. I've never managed to find a published version online or elsewhere. So I know nothing about it beyond what I actually have told you already and the words. We have to go deeper inside, like a tired miner chipping through stone. We have to dig even when we have had enough, and it is no longer worth it to get up out of the bed. The morning is cold, the grey clouds move in low, like a flock of dark crows over a picked field. That is when we have to go deeper, through another hard layer of pain. You have to be relentless to make it in this place, because it will be relentless with you. It will never stop beating and grinding, wearing you down with one more thing gone wrong. Friends will die, or their nerves will fail. Women will cease to be thrilled with you, and your sorry efforts to hold it all together will come to nothing. Men will cease to be thrilled with you, and your sorry efforts to hold it all together will come to nothing. You will still tremble in the leg, go grey and dim in the face, leak more every year in your yellowed shorts. Don't be in a hurry to pack it in.
The time will come when it is easier to die than to dig. The trick is to find the gold before death finds you, and then to sit there in the heart where you cannot be taken, while death storms and rages all around you, stealing everything in sight, but only left holding a bag full of bones. To find the gold before death finds you, and then to sit there in the heart where you cannot be taken, while death storms and rages all around you, stealing everything in sight, but only left holding a bag full of bones. So when we don't take hold of experience, we don't take birth in experience. And this is the condition in which we are open to being touched by, to realizing, to discovering what it is that is not subject to birth and death, that is not born and does not die. And it's not something far distant from us. In fact, it's not something at all. But it's right here. So close to us that we can't see it with our eyes. Closer than the very thoughts that flicker through our minds. So let's just sit quietly for a few minutes together. If you need to stretch or stand up for a moment, you're welcome to do so. So there's 15 minutes now for some walking again, and then there'll be lunch time, 1 o'clock through till 2:15 as yesterday. So, and from about, probably it'll be around 20-25 minutes to 1, I'll come over into the Tara room. If anyone wants to come and speak with me from that point, I'll be there. Prior to that, if we can keep it quiet, In fact, I'd really encourage you to stay with yourself over the lunchtime so far as you can, from practical things you might need to deal with, which hopefully aren't too many. And the contemplation for the next 15 minutes to really land with it in this next 15 minutes, and then to maybe, if you can, carry with you a little in the lunch period, whether you're resting or walking or while you're eating, it's to bring in this contemplation. And there's two different ways. Again, you might want to frame it. Just, it could be the question, who dies? If that resonates, or it feels like it might be, sometimes the questions don't resonate and then just do them anyway. But it's like, who dies? Like, let yourself be curious. Who dies? The same question as who's living, but we sort of answer that one more quickly. Somehow, who dies is a useful question to ask oneself. What is it we're talking about here? To not assume we already know. And the other question, the other contemplation is, what is that that does not die? Notice how the questions land for you. What is that that does not die? So again, the importance is the sense of opening oneself to the curiosity and the interest. Not answering the question, oh, who dies? It's me! Or what is it that doesn't die? Oh, God or Buddha nature or puppy nature or whatever. You know, that's not really going to be, it might be what your mind comes up with, but that's not really necessarily going to be that useful. Well, it might be, but it's more like, let yourself feel the question. If you can let yourself, if it's true for you that you don't know the whole answer, even though you might have some sense of part of it, or maybe even quite a lot of it, but there's always more to know in a response to these things. So even if one has some very deep experience in the territory, that doesn't mean one's plumbed it to the bottom, because it is without limit the depth one can explore here. So who dies? Who dies? And let it be personal. But it might also go in another direction. Or maybe both of. But in which case, take a little time with one. Don't just jump from one to the other. What is it that doesn't die? The mind might say, nothing. Yeah, it's the mind. Maybe it's right. Who knows? But come back to the question. Do you have a sense of that? Those contemplations? Again, you don't have to sort of run them through your mind like a steamroller. It's more like just, what is it like to ask it as if one really didn't know? As if one was a 6-year-old again and really wondering, you know, about life and death. And with that, of course, do enjoy your lunch, and based on yesterday's sort of situation, probably if not everyone turns up exactly at 1 o'clock, the experience won't be any different in terms of how long it takes to get your lunch, but you can do as you wish. And enjoy your lunch, please. We'll come back again at, what did I say? 2:15? Yeah? Good.